ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Get involved. Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower.
At abc.net.au/science. Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National
and at abc.net.au/science.
Hello, welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Later on today's program, the Baroque violinist Augusta Mackay Lodge is joining us to talk about Anna Maria della Pietà, a Venetian orphan who became a famous violinist and a muse to composers like Antonio Vivaldi. Before that, it's a pleasure to welcome back singer-songwriter Grace Cummings. We last spoke to her in 2022 when her album Storm Queen came out. That was, if you recall, rather bluesy and minimalist. Her voice was very much the centre of it. Rootsy and ragged as car wheels skidding over rocks, somebody wrote. Well, two albums later, we're up to Blood Horse. It's just come out and it's minimalism no longer. It's an ornate, incredibly strange record. I'm not going to try and describe it any further. We'll talk to Grace in a moment. Let's listen to how it starts. That's called The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Morphine, and it's the opening track of Blood Horse, the new album from Grace Cummings, and it's a pleasure to have her back on the music show. Grace, we should talk first of all about the title of the album. What's a blood horse?
It's kind of an archaic term, I suppose, for a thoroughbred that is bred to win, essentially, or bred for success, or bred for something great, but is also very fragile, very temperamental, flighty, and a lot of the time not capable of the success it was meant to have.
I'm sensing you identify with the blood horse.
Yeah, I mean, not in the success kind of way, but I think in the flighty way. I think there's some kind of chaotic passion and urgency in that image for me.
When I first listened to this album, I sent a message to my producer saying, this is magnificently weird.
Yeah, yay!
I haven't changed my mind about that. What we just heard, The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Morphine. I mean, I have to ask, was morphine involved in its creation?
No, it wasn't. Morphine is, I mean, you know, obviously it's a drug, but it is something that takes pain away, essentially. And that's what the word in this song and this album means to me.
You hear all sorts of influences mixed up that you wouldn't normally hear in the same kind of circumstances. I mean, quite apart from the obvious reference to Rodgers and Hammerstein, there's Velvet Underground, and there's Scott Walker, and see my producer, here's Neil Diamond.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I mean, they're all big, aren't they?
It's interesting hearing what references other people have, but I think probably everything that I do is big. Yeah, so I'll accept that because that's for certain. Even if it's something on the gentler side, it's always about something felt in a big way.
Yes, I wonder how the songs happen. It's almost as though you start with an enormous concept and then plan its contents, but I don't suppose you do. I imagine you do it one song at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I, a lot of the time, have absolutely no idea what I'm doing, and then I've done something and I have no idea how I did it. But I don't go into the studio with a concept, say. I now actually am writing an album with a concept because I've heard that question so much that I'm like, I'm going to answer it with a yes one day. So, wait around for that one. But this and previous albums, I kind of figure out what it all is after the fact. And it does make sense. And it does piece together, and it is a part of the same world, but not something that I'm aware of in the writing and the making. And I guess that's why you write and make things in the first place, you know, because it's like, for me, it's the way to process stuff and a lot of stuff that I don't understand yet, and to kind of like get whatever is in the basement out somehow. And this record, I actually wrote a lot of the songs there, some I wrote on the day or the day before.
And the sounds are obviously, they must, particularly since you wrote them so close to recording them, the sounds must have been a big part of the composition. It wasn't like you just had chords and a melody line. You had this grandeur in your head, I assume.
Mm. You know, working with Jonathan Wilson, who is my favourite, one of my favourite people in the world and a great friend and fellow freak, is the best to work with. I love working with him so much because he has that similar way of thinking and kind of understands where I'm going with something. And but I do think that, and I did think about, you know, like after Ramona, which is the last album I did and I did with Jonathan, I was then aware of what was possible to do, which was I mean, there was, it's kind of not much off the table.
No, you know. Listening to the album, I sense him there egging you on.
Yeah, he, what did we call him? Johnny Goodtime Wilson. He did egg me on. There's a song on the album called Witch, Witch, Witch. And I was in doing my vocals and, you know, not to blow smoke up my own proverbial, but Jonathan started speaking in my ears. He said, oh, Grace, you know, this isn't working out. You got to come in here. We got to talk about this. And he'd never really done that before. And I was like, what? What am I? I'm singing this, like, what could it be? It's weird, you know. If anything, he'd just be like, let's take another pass, you know, do it again. So I came into the control room and he's got this, you know, massive board in the control room and a scythe lying over it. The chorus of that song is, I sold my soul to the Reaper Man, and I come out and there's a scythe on the control room and I'm just like, what? First of all, where and how and why, John? Oh, but second of all, yes, I will pick that up and yes, I will sing with it in my hands. So it's kind of like, I love working with Jonathan because playfulness does not have a limit, and that's incredibly important to me. I think once you start getting pretty serious about stuff, I don't know, it doesn't, it's not my kind of vibe.
But they're not separate anyway, are they, being serious and being playful? And I have to ask, did the scythe help? Did it change the way you sang?
I mean, it felt good. That's important.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm talking to Grace Cummings and we're talking about her latest album, Blood Horse. Look, last time we spoke was when Storm Queen came out. The opening track of Storm Queen includes the line, there is no God, and yet he was all over that album and he's back on this one.
Mm-hmm. Yes, God is back. I always talk about God, not because I know what that is. It isn't a particular thing for me, but I think using that language, it's a shortcut to talking about the human condition, you know? Like, when you talk about God, it's kind of like a please help me or thank you for helping me, whatever it is, you know? It's just the biggest word to encapsulate that.
My God is a jail. Half an eye, 100 gnashing teeth. never chose the me. Just a pig rolling in satin sheets. And in the corner of the atmosphere, he's getting ready to call you darling. An enemy with a handshake, a cry in line, a little money.
That's My God. It's Grace Cummings, and it's from her latest album, Blood Horse. Can we talk about your voice? Because it's a very particular instrument, and I understand you had pneumonia when you did that track.
I did get pneumonia in that time, and I wasn't supposed to be doing anything, obviously, but I couldn't get over how interesting my breathing sounded. So I thought, let's just lash ourselves a little bit more, and I'm going to use this because it sounds interesting. And I recorded all the breathing when I was struggling very hard to breathe.
When you're in the studio being egged on, I wonder whether you talk about other music a lot, because there seem to be so many little references here and there, sometimes in the lyrics, sometimes in the sounds to other music. Mm. Do you kind of wrap yourselves in all of these other sounds?
We do all the time. I mean, I never stop talking about music. I love it so much, you know. So it just continues when you're making something, really. I mean, it's sometimes all we ever talk about, me and my band and me and my friends and me and Jonathan or whoever. It's the thing that we love. So we're constantly talking about what we love or trying to figure out what was that they did there? How did they get that sound? How could I get that sound? You know, that kind of thing is endless.
the last time we spoke about Storm Queen, that title track starts with the line, Towns Van Zandt took a hold of my hand so I wouldn't feel alone. Mm. Is that a common feeling when you listen to another singer or another musician that they are reaching out?
I think that is what I feel with any kind of art that moves me. I think that looking at a painting that I love, I think that listening to a song that moves me, and I also think that I hold my own hand in times of loneliness playing music just to myself. I think that's what it is for all of us, really.
We're going to finish with John Lennon Lennon. Maybe we could talk about him, about John Lennon, and then about the song. Is he somebody else who holds your hand?
Absolutely.
He wrote a song about it, come to think of it, didn't he?
He's held my hand for a very long time, since I was a child. And I was thinking, if he was here, what would he think about the world, you know? If he was still here, what would he think? And I suppose in that he's almost like a greater force, because it's like, here's what's going on, John, but also please help me. But John Lennon Lennon is actually something that I learnt from Jonathan Wilson when we were doing Ramona. It's a way to play the guitar in a particular rhythm. it's a strumming pattern. Down, down, up, down, up, down. John, Lennon, Lennon. Or down, up, down, up, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought that was the most fantastic thing when he told me to do that. He was like, maybe play it in a John, Lennon, Lennon. I was like, pardon me? And I had to make that into a song.
Yeah, it was like a ready-made.
Yeah, I was like, I'm doing that.
Listen, congratulations on the album, Grace. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming on the music show again, and we should listen to John Lennon.
Thanks for having me.
A tear rolled down my mother.
That's John Lennon, sung by Grace Cummings, from her new album, Blood Horse. There's an exclamation mark after Blood Horse. It's out now. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. This is Mara. That's Mara Schwertfeger, who we've had on the music show a few times. She's a sound designer, a violist, and she's part of the experimental collective Worlds Only. What we heard there was Loosening My Grip. It comes from her new release featuring strings by Abby Sundborn. Mara's playing at Phoenix Central Park in Sydney on the 18th of August. It's a fantastic building. You should see it. It's the Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. You might have heard on Late Night Live the other night David Marr discussing a composer from the Venetian orphanage whose most famous 18th century patron was the composer Antonio Vivaldi. Well, we've got one of their violinists on our show. Anna Maria Della Pieta is the historical focus for Augusta Mackay Lodge's concerts that are on now with the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra. I spoke to her last week, Augusta, that is, not Anna Maria, from her home in Paris, and we'll hear that conversation after we've heard music written for Anna Maria by Vivaldi himself. That's a slow movement from the violin concerto by Vivaldi in E major. Per Anna Maria is its subtitle, played there by Théotime Langlois du Swart with members of Orchestre Le Consort. And it's one of the pieces that will be played by my guest, Augusta Bouquet Lodge, in the forthcoming concerts with the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra. She joins me now from Paris. Welcome to the music show.
Thank you, Andy.
And who's Anna Maria?
Anna Maria was an extraordinary musician during the time of Vivaldi. She was actually one of the, for lack of a better term, orphans at the Ospedale in Venice. And Vivaldi would have been her teacher. And she was an incredible violinist. We know that many composers, of course, all male composers, the times being as they were, would travel from far and wide across Europe to come and hear her play. So we know she was incredibly gifted. And luckily for us, her music notebook, her part book, exists, which was found in Venice, a beautiful leather-bound, embossed part book. And in it, we can see some of the concertos she actually owned, Vivaldi concertos, and a lot of this program that we'll be doing are in that notebook. So it's just an incredible little bit of history. And she may have even composed some of that music. We don't really know. Of course, Vivaldi would have put his name on it. So it's, you know, it's something that's been knowledge that's lost to us now. But it's amazing to think of her in that light.
When you said before, for want of a better term, you mean she might not have been an orphan?
Well, the Ospedale actually means basically a hospital. And what it was parents who, you know, either couldn't raise a child or hadn't wanted a child, would come and basically drop these babies off in a little revolving door in the side of this church so that they could give their baby up anonymously. But those parents were still living. So they were abandoned babies who were taken in by the Ospedale. And some of them would just live there and do daily chores and not have much of an education and kind of, you know, just get by and be fed very minimally. And then the lucky ones would be part of the, I think it was called the coro. They would become musicians, and the Ospedale really pushed them to do this because they were extremely talented, and it was a way as well for the Ospedale to put on these performances and to invite nobility. And they were treated better. They even got to eat more food, they did less chores, and they were able to practice together. And so that was like the thing you wanted to do, right? And so Anna Maria was one of those kids. You know, for these young women who were abandoned, they didn't have many prospects in those days because they couldn't really be married off, which at the time was sort of, you know, ultimately what you needed to do. You know, we have sources saying that they were slightly deformed or they had, you know, these birthmarks or whatever. So it was just this different time where they weren't really able to integrate into society in the way that they needed to. And so this was an outlet for them to become these performers. And they would perform behind iron grates so that no one could see them, because they were playing instruments that were not proper for young women to play at that time, like wind instruments that was considered not proper for a woman to play. And each one of them, like Anna Maria, we know that she played multiple instruments, wind instruments, keyboard, violin. They sang. They did full part choirs and sang the bass lines. I mean, these were incredible women.
But, and she's Anna Maria della Pieta. Why della Pieta?
Well, she did not have a surname. None of them had surnames because they were given up anonymously. And so they were sort of, you know, given these placeholder names. So she's Anna Maria da Pietà.
And the relationship with Vivaldi and the other visiting musicians, I mean, what would be the modern equivalent? Were they almost apprentices, or were they doing sort of the equivalent of master classes?
Mm-hmm. Vivaldi was the violin teacher there and also the orchestra leader, and he took it very seriously. He was extremely well paid, and so he spent a lot of time there. He ran orchestra rehearsals. He put on concerts. I know that they were very, you know, doing a lot of performances. He was writing music for the children. In a way, they were sort of probably his muses as well. I think these girls were extremely talented. And probably they were apprenticing as well, so probably copying out parts for him, maybe composing music for him, we don't know, but wouldn't be surprised. And he was giving them lessons as well, violin lessons, also on other instruments. And we know that he bought instruments for the orchestra as well. We have the records. Luckily, the Ospedale was very tight with their record keeping, and a lot of those documents have survived. So we have records even of the actual price that he paid for instruments. So he was really, you know, it was a one-man show. He was sort of leading the whole thing. And he would invite other famous composers like Tartini, Pisendal, I believe, to come and see some of these performances as well. Casanova came as well. So a lot of interesting figures coming through.
And so they're sitting there looking at a screen, and they know that there are young girls behind it playing instruments that they're not supposed to be playing. But it's kind of, so there's a kind of element of hypocrisy.
It was this sort of, right, it was this little niche where it was like, oh, well, this is okay because this is what it is. It's its own thing. Yeah. Yeah, I think also they were probably hidden behind the screen for their safety as well. It's really hard to know exactly what those times were like. But yeah, I think it was better in general that they sort of protected in that way.
I think so too. Maybe we could broaden our conversation and talk about you and your instruments. Well, you specialize in playing historical violin. Obviously, nobody starts playing historical violin, so you have played modern violin as well. Can you, and I realize that the answer to this question is probably 3 hours long and we've got seven minutes, but can you tell us what the difference is, say, from a physical point of view?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a physical difference and there's an approach difference to historical performance. So we try to use the equipment they were using back then. I put in quotation marks with my fingers because back then is a huge, you know, huge span of years. But let's say in the Baroque times, let's say 18th century, we try to use the exact measurements they would have had. Nowadays, when you see, for example, a Stradivarius violin, you have to know that that instrument, a lot of the equipment on it has actually been changed to modern standards. So this includes the fingerboard, which is where your fingers play on, has become longer and thinner to accommodate more and more virtuosic music as we go through history. Now we have put on these instruments a chin rest and a shoulder rest to hold on to it better. But in, let's say, the 18th century, they didn't have that. The bows have become longer and convex instead of concave, so you can put more pressure on them now and sustain a sound, whereas before, the sound would gradually diminuendo with the arc of the bow, and so you couldn't really sustain in the same way. And all these physical changes are important because if you play on the instruments as they were back then, as I said, with the bow, it totally changes the sound and your approach to the music. And so that's really what we're talking about when we say historical performance. You can do historical performance on a quote-unquote modern violin, but it's really the approach to the music, the fact that they were basing their music very much off of speech and rhetoric and not so much off of the bel canto singing that we think of now. So there's less sustain, there's more variation in dynamics and punctuation, the same as like when you're talking. And it was very dance-based as well, because dance was such a huge thing in the Baroque times. And so you get this totally different sounding music. If you take a piece by Bach and you play it on a Baroque violin, you're going to end up having a lighter, more punctuated version than on a modern violin. You'll have a more singing, sustained version, which really is quite modern and wouldn't have been how they had done it. And the big difference, and then I'll stop talking, the big difference is the gut strings. So the strings we use for the Baroque times are made out of pure animal gut, as opposed to the metal steel strings that we've gone to actually quite recently, like late 20th century. Those change the sound so much that it's so round and beautiful, and it doesn't project as much, so it's made for smaller concert halls. Very interesting. Once you play on gut, you never go back, in my opinion.
So is it that it comes down to this, that you could do all of these things on a modern violin, but you'd have to try really hard, whereas if you play an old violin, it does it for you?
Right. You can do it on a modern violin. You just have to battle against your equipment a little bit.
You're talking to me from Paris, and our listeners will have picked up that you do not have a French accent. And I wonder whether you think about the fact that you come from a country where the music that you're playing didn't happen. I mean, that history is not an American history any more than it's an Australian history. Is that why you moved to Paris?
In part, yes. I mean, I love my American history, and there's a lot of fascinating things to find in the early musical history, but it's true. We just don't have that kind of legacy in history. And that is one of the incredible things about living here in Paris, in France. I've been here for 8 years now, and it's amazing at what point Baroque music is just such a part of the culture. And, you know, people don't even blink an eye when you talk about historical performance. They all know about it. They're all well-informed. They love it. The Baroque orchestras here are just, you know, top-notch, super famous. And we get to play in beautiful venues like Versailles and all these old churches and cathedrals. And, you know, it does, yeah, absolutely, it does lend an incredible side to the music. And it does make it easier to kind of, well, speaking of Anna Maria, when I was in Venice, you know, you really are in their land and you can project into their story a little bit better than if I was sitting in like Chicago, for example. I originally came over because I was recruited by the conductors of the orchestra I play with, mainly Les Airs Florissants, and I never looked back.
And that was founded by an American, of course, William Christie.
Of course, yeah, William Christie, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much indeed, Augusta McKay-Lodge, for talking to me on the music show. We're going to hear some Pisandel violin sonata in A minor, and we're going to hear you playing it. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, this is an incredible piece of music. It's very tortured and wandering in a way, which is sort of stylistic to his music. And we know that he does have a connection with Anna Maria and with Vivaldi. And it's incredible to kind of see how the styles tie into each other and at the same are so, so different. So I'll let you discover that for yourselves. But it's a beautiful piece. Beautiful.
Thanks very much. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Augusta Mackay Lodge playing Pisendel's Violin Sonata in A minor, and she is playing with the Australian Brandenburg Orchestra in a series of concerts called Vivaldi's Legacy in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. You'll find details on the music show's website. Back to the subject of late night life stealing our thunder, they've also just had on Susan Tomes, our old friend, the pianist and writer, talking about nocturnes, and you might like to catch up with that as well. We should do some hard-hitting political stuff, I think, on the music show. Next time on the music show, not hard-hitting political stuff, but we will have the pianist Maki Namikawa talking about Philip Glass's music. She premiered the complete piano etudes for Glass, one of her many notable performances of his work, and she's back in Australia to play the first 10 of them once again. Also, great to welcome back Kate Miller-Heitke, who's got a new album out called The Kiss and the Abyss, and she's coming in to sing songs from it for us. And I've been doing this so long, I don't know if I'm capable of ever really going back to the way it was. It's a secondary life.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.